It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up from scalding hot geysers to peaceful Wisconsin landscapes, we'll look back at the career of a Wisconsin microbiologist who changed the world of biology and paved the way for tests that detect the virus that causes COVID-19. First, President Biden announced a new goal for vaccinations yesterday. The administration wants at least 70% of American adults to have their first shot by the 4th of July, about 2 months from now. That comes as vaccination rates are starting to slow down in Wisconsin and across the country, something Biden acknowledged in a speech yesterday.
Now we're going to have to bring the vaccine to people who are less eager. So we also know that there are millions of Americans who just need a little bit of encouragement to get the shot.
That's one of our topics in our weekly look at the top stories in national news. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this latest goal to vaccinate 70% of adults over to reach that mark over the next 2 months? Are you holding off on getting vaccinated? What do you think it'll take to get people who are hesitant to get vaccinated? Also coming up, we'll look at a leadership dispute in the Republican Party. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lisa Mascaro is chief congressional correspondent for the Associated Press. Lisa, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
I want to start with a quick look at this vaccination goal from the Biden administration. What changes here in their targets?
Yeah, you know, well, the president has laid out this new 70% target by July 4th. And I think it's a step back a little bit from that idea of getting to sort of a broader herd immunity. My colleagues at the White House have been reporting on this for the AP, and they sort of talked about that it's really just to get as many shots in the arms, sort of realizing that there are a number of vaccine hesitant people right now. And there's a declining interest in shots, and it's difficult to maybe get to that broader goal of fully wiping out the virus. That said, you can get to, the more people that are vaccinated, the more they believe it can keep the virus in check. And so getting there, they're ramping up efforts. My colleagues are reporting they're almost hitting about a million doses a day. And, you know, more than half of Americans have at least had one dose. So, you know, they were reporting 56% as of yesterday. So the president is well on the way to getting to the 70% at that rate. But, you know, there are drop-offs, and a number of states are having to give back their what the amount of doses that they're allocated, because they're just not having demand. So the president acknowledged that as well, that there's going to be a need to, you know, try to work with people and encourage those who are hesitant to think about their options and think about their plans here going forward.
Let's move to your beat in Congress now. I want to give a listen to House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. He was caught on a hot mic talking to a Fox News host about Liz Cheney. And this is part of a big, maybe leadership change coming up on the Republican side of the House. Here's a listen.
I think she's got real problems. I've had it with her. It's, you know, I've lost confidence.
So Wyoming House Representative Liz Cheney, she's made comments about former President Trump in the past. Why are we hearing Republicans, especially Republicans in House leadership, talking about, hey, maybe now's the time to take her out of this number three spot among Republicans?
Yeah, the House Republicans are really at sort of an unprecedented crossroads here with this question before them. They are facing a real choice. It shows the influence that the former president Donald Trump still has over the party, out of office, away down in Florida, his private life. Yet he is still watching and very critical of those who are critical of him. Former president and Liz Cheney, who folks might remember is the daughter of the former vice president Dick Cheney. They've been going back and forth over the election results. You know, the former president still claims that he won the election. He, you know, promotes falsehoods, that the vote was not fair. And Liz Cheney is one of the few in Congress who has been willing to counter that and call it out and say, you know, that's wrong. And she really sort of tipped the scales about a week ago when she gave some comments. She is a member of party leadership, and so she gets asked questions by reporters. And in a setting at the House Republican retreat last week, she was asked and she answered some questions about forming this January 6th commission that Congress has been considering, sort of a 9/11 style commission to kind of really look at what happened in the insurrection at the Capitol and what can be improved with policing to keep the Capitol secure, ensure the safety of lawmakers and the public that's coming to Washington to, you know, interact with Congress. That commission has not been able to get off the ground. And she was asked about it. And she said, you know, yes, we need this commission. It was a big break from party leaders. It was a big break, and it seemed to be sort of the last straw. And it rekindled this whole back and forth with the former president. Of course, Liz Cheney had led a group of Republicans to vote for his impeachment back in January in the House when he was impeached a second time over that insurrection. In any case, this is all coming to a point. The House is away this week, but they'll be back next week. And House Republicans are seriously thinking of holding this internal vote to cast her out of her leadership position. She's the number three leader, the highest ranking woman in Republican woman in Congress, cast her out. And it looks like, from what folks are telling us, she will, in fact, lose that position if that vote is called.
Talking to Lisa Mascaro, chief congressional correspondent for the Associated Press, with us for our weekly look at the top stories in national politics right now, talking about a dispute among Republicans in the House. You can weigh in on that at 800-642-1234. Do you think Liz Cheney should be removed from her Republican leadership position in the House? What do you make of this dispute over the role of former President Trump in the future of the Republican Party? Call in at 800-642-1234. And Lisa, a lot of times it seems like these leadership challenges in Congress are kind of insider baseball in politics. A lot of people seem to be looking at this and reading it as really a debate over the future of the Republican Party. Is it all about loyalty to former President Trump and his version of the 2020 election? Or is it about something with party and principle? Is that overreading it, do you think, or is there something to that?
You know, that's really how a lot of people here in Washington and in people involved in party politics are viewing it. You know, as we were sort of saying, Liz Cheney is one of the few who has stuck her neck out to be critical of the president, particularly on this issue of the election. And she has said, you know, that the party cannot move forward if it buys into this view that the election was taken from Donald Trump, that that's just, it's inaccurate, it's wrong, it's essentially a lie, and the party cannot move forward if it continues to lean into that. You know, a number of Republican voters hold that view. So she is counter to many voters and certainly to the president. Yet there are a number of Republicans and others across the country who say this is a pivotal moment because, you know, there has been no evidence of problems with the election on a scale that would have tipped the balance to the former president. All indications are that President Biden won the election fair and square. And for Trump to continue to sow doubt and for his allies in Congress to allow those falsehoods to continue is a real, you know, turning point for the party, the party of Abraham Lincoln, and, you know, a problem point for the nation that needs to have faith in its civic institutions and most certainly in the vote. So this question is, you know, can Republican lawmakers speak their minds and speak freely and stand up to Trump, or do they need to fall in line, or they're going to lose their positions too? And I don't think it's a stretch. I think a lot of people see that as the question today. I mean, it was very telling. Senate Leader McConnell made a visit in his home state in Kentucky today, and, you know, had a press conference and was at, you know, people might remember after former President Trump was impeached the second time over the insurrection, Leader McConnell stood up on the Senate floor and just gave a blistering speech against Trump and about what he had done to sort of encourage his supporters to come to the Capitol that day. And, you know, it was very eye-opening because Leader McConnell doesn't always talk that way. So for it to come from him was very strong from him, for him to be critical of the president. Asked today if, you know, he had any concerns about these ongoing disputes over the election, if he had any plans to help Liz Cheney save her position. And he would not answer those questions. He said he's focused only on stopping Biden's agenda. And, you know, he was not willing to, you know, stick his neck out for Liz Cheney. And I think those are all moments that people are noticing, people who follow politics, at least, you know, are really noticing of what, which way the Republican Party is going to go here. Of course, President Biden made some comments today as well about the party. Anyway,
I want to bring in a caller. Frank is with us in Door County. Frank, hello.
Yes, good afternoon. I've been following the career of Liz Cheney for quite some time. I have not always agreed with her, but I felt that she was principled in what she thought. Her arguments were, well, you could track her arguments and positions, very pragmatic, and honest in her approach to things, sometimes to her detriment, as we've heard recently. And so I could not have imagined 10 years ago I would be going to bat for Liz Cheney. But I am also going to bat for the Republican Party's soul at this point. I think at this point they have had a choice all along of who they would follow. And they have decided out for whatever reason to follow one person rather than an ideology or positions that they have held in the past.
Frank, thanks a lot for the call. And that reminds me, I'm seeing ratings from conservative groups over the past few years. Lisa, rating Liz Cheney very high in her votes on conservative issues. Her proposed replacement, Elise Stefanik, substantially lower, 20-30% lower when it comes to conservative ideal type votes. What do you think what Frank had to say about Cheney's role in the party and her ideals?
You know, it's a really interesting statistic. That's interesting polling. I mean, Liz Cheney is nothing if not one of the, you know, more conservative members of Congress, comes from a, you know, very conservative state and a very conservative, you know, family. I'll never forget one of her first press conferences in 2017 at a Republican retreat. She was introduced and she got up and someone asked her a question about waterboarding. You know, her father, of course, was, you know, very much involved in that whole era in the Bush administration of, you know, detainee, you know, questions over the U.S. handling of detainees from the Iraq-Afghanistan war. And, you know, she sort of stood up and stood by it. And, you know, those are her views. She's very, you know, very conservative in so many ways. And yet, you know, on this issue, we've seen over and over again lawmakers who try to confront Trump often lose. I mean, we look back at, you know, Senator Jeff Flake, who at one point was sort of the leader of the, you know, fiscally conservative, no earmarks, no deficits wing of the House Republicans, sort of before the Freedom Caucus House Republicans, you know, before the Tea Party. When Jeff Flake became a senator and started speaking out against Trump, you know, he found he wouldn't be able to win re-election and had to quit. You know, we see Mitt Romney getting booed in Salt Lake City. I mean, here he was the party's, you know, presidential nominee at one point, and, you know, getting booed because of his vote to impeach the president over the insurrection at the Capitol. So it is very difficult for even some of the most conservative members, some of the members that have championed the ideals of the party, to withstand the pressure from Trump and his supporters.
Thanks for the call, Frank. We're talking to Lisa Mascaro, Chief Congressional Correspondent for the AP, with us today to talk about some big stories in national news. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have thoughts about the House GOP trying to remove Representative Liz Cheney from a leadership position. Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We are continuing our Week in Washington conversation with Lisa Mascaro from AP, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Let's go back to our callers now on Liz Cheney and her leadership position in the House. Michael is with us in Wauwatosa. Michael, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I just wanted to make a comment on Liz Cheney's position. My thinking is there's nothing outstanding about her being holding up with her integrity and proliferating the truth and honesty. What's outstanding and frankly mind-blowing is the rest of the Republican Party that continues to proliferate this crazy lie in face of all the evidence. And to me, I would think when they saw that Donald Trump lost the election, I would have thought they would have taken a big sigh of relief and said, oh, good. Now we can get back to normal. Now we can be the party of the Republicans instead of the party of Donald Trump. And I just cannot believe that there's such a large, vast majority of Republicans that are still holding on to this madman. That's my comment.
Michael, thanks for the call. Lisa, what are your thoughts on, I guess, the calculations for leading Republicans in Congress for why they wouldn't want to ditch Donald Trump at this point?
Your caller raises this really interesting point, and I think this is what we're seeing play out between Liz Cheney and the other members of Republican leadership in the House. Kevin McCarthy is the Republican leader. He is just a few votes away. You know, the House is very narrowly split. We often talk about the Senate being so split 50-50. The House is also just a few votes away from tipping to the other side, to Republican control. And Leader McCarthy believes, you know, that keeping Trump close, going to Mar-a-Lago, asking for his support, having him is a way to continue to build off the enthusiasm that the former president was able to bringing in voters who didn't often vote, you know, or had voted Democrat in the past, and then expanding the party, the sort of big tent out from there. You see the same thing happening on the Senate side with the Republican Senate leader, a campaign leader, Rick Scott, going down to Mar-a-Lago, asking President Trump for his support of Republican Senate candidates. Liz Cheney has a different theory of a case, which a number of other Republicans share, which is Trump kind of has a ceiling. You know, and we saw that over and over in both his approval ratings, you know, just barely getting to 40%. And then also in the vote, right? He wasn't able to win the presidency. Republicans lost the special elections, the Senate races down in Georgia. They lost control of the Senate. And they also, 2 years earlier, had lost control of the House. And so sticking with Trump from a pure political point of view might not be such a great idea either, because he brings in a core group, but you can't sort of grow that group and reach out. And we saw that with voters peeling away from Republicans, turning back toward Democrats to go ahead and vote for President Biden. You know, your suburban voters in particular are always watched here. Suburban women, which way do they go? You know, suburban voters are often play such a key in those back and forth decisions. And that's really sort of two different theories of the case. And right now it seems like the stick with Trump theory is the one that the Republicans believe is the winning one for them.
And I want to take our last few minutes, Lisa, to look at a story of cooperation in the U.S. Congress for an infrastructure bill, a water bill. What did this do, and why did it get so much support on both sides of the aisle?
Yes, well, we were sort of talking last week that never does such a sort of modest water resources bill carry so much buzz in Congress. But that little water bill that passed the Senate, I mean, I say little, but it is in the scope of what we're talking about, some $35 billion over 10 years to fix leaky pipes and provide other infrastructure. But it got enormous bipartisan support. And a lot of folks sort of looked at it as a possible roadmap of the kinds of infrastructure projects that could get support on both sides of the aisle and become potential building blocks for sort of a broader package. You know, of course, President Biden has proposed this sweeping $2.3 trillion infrastructure package, and then an additional $1.8 trillion sort of families package that invests in, you know, all these other sort of new ways of looking at infrastructure. We call it the human infrastructure, I guess, is the way that it's being framed. You know, child care centers and hospitals and things like that. But this little water bill was able to get support. It went through the sort of regular committee process. It got brought to the floor. The new Democratic leader of the Senate, Chuck Schumer, has promised that he will allow sort of robust debates and amendments and not just try to jam everything through as maybe it had been done in the past. And so they had a big debate and it passed. And so people got really excited. Senators got really excited. They've got a lot of pent up desire to actually legislate, which is something they haven't done a lot of in the last few years because of all the gridlock. And so we'll see, you know, it's a small little step. And certainly, you know, there doesn't seem to be vast support from Republicans for the kind of investment that Biden is talking about. But perhaps they could get a little bit of the way there. And that might be something that all sides could sort of point to as some success. You know, I think they all sort of have some agreement that roads and bridges and broadband and water resources are all things that need to be upgraded in this country, airports and ports and, you know, whatnot. So we'll see. We'll see if they get there. But it was a little mini breakthrough, you know, in Congress, which doesn't always have a lot of breakthroughs.
We'll leave it there for now. Lisa, thanks for joining us again today.
You bet, Rob. Thanks for having me.
That's Lisa Mascaro, chief congressional correspondent for the Associated Press. She joined us today to talk about a GOP effort to kick the number three House Republican out of her leadership job, a moment of bipartisan agreement on a water-related infrastructure bill and other top stories in national politics. Coming up after the news, a Wisconsin microbiologist who passed away last month changed the world of biology, and his work laid the groundwork for the timely development of a COVID-19 screening test. We'll look back at his career and his work. You can follow conversations like these all the time here on the Ideas Network at WPR.org, where you can listen live or check back on our archives or download the WPR app to your device that you carry around with you. Or just turn on a radio, depending on where you are. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, Governor Evers wants to increase funding for a statewide land conservation program. Kate Archer Kent and her guests look at the history and impact of the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Fund and its future here in the state. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Now, the microbiologist Thomas Brock passed away at age 94 last month at his home in Madison. Brock worked as a professor in UW-Madison's bacteriology department for many years. His work changed the way microbiologists understand microbes and had a far-reaching impact in many other fields along the way. Technically, without Brock's work, forensic crime shows like CSI would be science fiction. Here he is talking about his work.
The important thing is to make a contribution, some sort of a contribution to society. That's what I always considered. I thought science is the way to do that. And the more knowledge you get, the better.
Talking now with the life and work of UW microbiologist Thomas Brock. If you happen to have worked with him or taken a class from him or have questions about his work, you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Joe Handelsman is director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery and a professor in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. She served as science advisor under President Obama. Joe was a longtime colleague of Thomas Brock. Joe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, you and he had overlapping careers, I understand, at UW-Madison. Can you share some memories about Tom Brock as somebody to work with, a coworker?
Well, when I first met him, I remember being quite intimidated by him. Tom was very tall, and he had a loud voice, and he had kind of a blustery personality. And I thought that he was very brusque at the beginning, and it took me a while to figure out that he's actually was a really warm and caring person and very eager to help other people. And of course, his intellect was about as big as he was physically. He had a big personality, big mind, and a big impact.
And we're going to meet one of his colleagues a little bit who was there with him for one of his biggest discoveries. Can you talk about Brock's work on microbes and how they really changed what we know as microbiology today?
Well, Tom gave us our understanding of a lot of the microbiology of Yellowstone Park, which is where he did a lot of the work that ultimately became his big breakthrough that you'll hear about. But he taught us a lot about the specific knowledge of the microbes that lived there at these extremely high temperatures and very uncomfortable conditions. And that was extraordinary in itself. But the bigger concept that he really gave me as a gift was that we can't detect all microbes by culturing them in petri dishes. And it was a period of time where most microbiology was still done in the petri dish, and that had gone on for about 120 years. And Tom was the voice in the wilderness saying, no, they're not all culturable, so you're missing most of the story if you just culture them. And later he became, something of a hero for many of us because he made us aware of that. It took me about a decade of hearing him say that to finally start using culture-free conditions that circumvented culturing. But he was saying that for decades before anybody moved in that direction. And one of the sort of ironies was that he made that argument, and then the work that he did led to the very method that allowed us to detect microbes without culturing, to detect their DNA and not just grow them on plates. So he really contributed to his own passion, which was seeing the microbes that are unseeable on petri dishes.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about how his work with, as you say, some of these extreme microbes that could survive in this scalding hot condition of a Yellowstone geyser, how that led to this PCR test that a lot of us may know of from the COVID-19 testing people have gotten over the last year?
Well, the PCR test and method was dependent upon being able to do what we call melting DNA, so separating strands of DNA. And we do that with heat. And so the idea behind PCR was to make lots and lots of copies of a single strand of DNA. And that meant melting and then copying the melted strands and then letting them go back together to be a pair and then melting them again and copying them. And so that's why it's called amplification, because every time you made a copy, then you would melt it open and make a new copy, and that would amplify it exponentially. But the problem with the idea, which occurred before the problem was solved, the problem was that you couldn't keep heating the protein, the enzyme that was needed to make the copies of the DNA. And so you'd end up having to keep adding protein. Every time you melted it, you'd add and let it re-anneal, you would add more protein. And you'd end up with this big, big kind of goopy mess of tons of protein, and the reactions wouldn't work. And Tom discovered the bacterium that would live at these high temperatures where you can melt normal DNA, and the bacterial enzyme that copies the DNA will just act perfectly happy and normal. And you can then cool it down. The enzyme will do its job and make copies. You can melt it again at high temperature. The protein lives. So it was that bacterium that lived at these excruciatingly high temperatures in Yellowstone that gave us that enzyme that allowed us to copy DNA repeatedly in what's called the polymerase chain reaction, or PCR.
Talking to Joe Handelsman, director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery, colleague of the microbiologist Thomas Brock, who passed away last month in Madison, talking about his career and his huge contributions to the world of science. And Joe, this story makes me think of the old TV show Connections, where here, you know, a microbiologist is curious about what's living in a geyser, and what, six decades later, it's helping us test for this pandemic-causing virus. Can you talk about just the value of basic research and curiosity, even when you don't know what you're going to get out of it in the long run?
Yeah, Tom became sort of a symbol for that. In fact, he won what was called the Golden Goose Award, which is an award that was developed in response to the Golden Fleece Award, which was something that our very own Senator Proxmire started, that was to make fun of science that sounded so obscure and so irrelevant that nobody would really be interested in doing it. And he would use it as an example of scientists wasting government money. And so a group came up with the answer to that, which was the Golden Goose Award, which is very, very basic and seemingly obscure science that doesn't have an application when it's done, but then has magnificent implications for applied science and for solving practical problems later on. And what the Golden Goose Award and the whole our whole understanding now of basic research and its impact on society tells us is that when we set out to solve a very applied problem, we rarely make the gigantic step that we need to make that problem really tractable. And that's what Tom's work did so beautifully, that he was studying these obscure bacteria. People would sort of, I remember people almost rolling their eyes at, oh, he's studying the Yellowstone bacteria again. You know, like, what is the good of that? And here it had this enormous impact on really all of biology and an enormous amount of testing that we do in medicine and in agriculture and environmental sciences.
I understand Thomas Brock wasn't just into microbiology. He got a little macro with his biological interests, including prairie restoration and ecology here in the state. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I think a lot of us kind of thought that Tom had two careers, and he was a microbiologist for probably, I don't know, 50 years and made just enormous contributions. But then he took his passion, his intensity, that amazing intellect, and it is also his physical strength and love of being out in the environment, and he applied it to prairie restoration and environmental restoration across the state. I remember working with him once on a site here in Madison where we were trying to get rid of all the garlic mustard. And, you know, when Tom asked you to do something, if you cared about him as much as I did, you didn't say no. So I didn't know anything about garlic mustard at the time, but he taught me that it was this horrible weed and we needed to eradicate it so that it didn't produce seeds and spread. So I went out and pulled garlic mustard with him. And it was just an amazing event because I remember all of us were kind of fading by the end of the day. My back was hurting and I was kind of tired of pulling garlic mustard, and Tom was going strong. He just had this incredible, endless energy. And first he spent years applying it to microbiology and then made amazing contributions later on to prairie restoration.
And before I let you go, Joe, how did Tom influence you as a teacher?
He had an enormous impact on my teaching through one of his books. So Tom was a very prolific and beautiful writer. And in addition to the science that he did, the experiments he did, he also studied the history of microbiology and wrote a wonderful series of books about some of the great microbiologists and great discoveries. And one of them was a book about Robert Koch, who was one of the microbiologists of the 19th century that really set microbiology on its route to culturing, which is also one of the interesting twists of the story, that one of his great subjects, Tom's great subjects, was Robert Koch, who introduced the Petri dish. He was the first one to actually culture bacteria on a solid surface. And that was, of course, the method that Tom used, but also said, that's just not enough. We're not seeing all the bacteria if we use that. But it was Tom's book on Robert Koch that gave me the basis for teaching a non-majors biology course where I taught the scientific method, because Tom laid out how Robert Koch came up with his hypothesis, tested it over a Christmas holiday, as Tom described it, and worked in his little home lab while he wasn't a doctor. It's a wonderful story. And was the person who established that bacteria can cause disease, which we didn't know in the 1870s and 80s. And so it was that chapter in his book that I used in teaching for years and years. And my students always loved it because it's such a memorable story, but it also teaches the essence of great science.
Joe, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
That was Joe Handelsman, director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery, professor in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. We're looking at the career of Thomas Brock, UW-Madison microbiologist who changed the world of biology in a lot of ways and beyond. Coming up, we'll meet one of his colleagues who was part of one of his biggest discoveries hidden in a scalding geyser. So we'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation about UW microbiologist Thomas Brock, who passed away last month at the age of 94. Brock's discovery of the superheat-resistant bacteria Thermus aquaticus in the 1960s was essential to the invention of the polymerase chain reaction, or PCR, in the 1980s. If you've heard about PCR lately, it's a key part of COVID-19 testing technology. And a lot more. Hudson Freeze is director of the Sanford Children's Health Research Center and the Human Genetics Program at the Sanford Burnham Prebys Medical Discovery Institute in San Diego. Freeze was Brock's undergraduate assistant during his 1960s trip to Yellowstone, where the two discovered the bacterium Thermus aquaticus. Hudson, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks a lot, Rob, for having me on. This is a real privilege to talk about Tom.
Thank you so much for joining us. Could you take us back to Yellowstone as you and Tom were snooping around looking for life in geysers?
Oh, yeah. My gosh, what an opportunity. I had never left Indiana, and I had never been any farther west than the Chicago Stockyards. So the opportunity to go to Yellowstone was really a treat. I'm a 20-year-old kid, can't even drink yet. And so Tom made me this offer, and I thought, well, I can't turn this thing down. But, you know, what's going to be so interesting about Yellowstone other than the things we already know about? And once I got there, you know, my jaw just dropped. And Tom was such an inspiration because, you know, as I think you just heard, he was this very strong, he's tall, 6'4", and he had strides that would embarrass an Olympian. And so when we would head for the spring, Tom would lead and everybody would try to keep up with him. And the enthusiasm, I would say his enthusiasm bubbled over as much as any geyser. And you could just sense the excitement that he had and that he brought along, you know, for all of us to follow. And, you know, make no mistake, he was very serious about his science. You know, he might seem like a kid in the candy store, but he was dead serious about getting the science done.
Well, now he was a unique type. And then you and he found this unique specimen, this bacterium, Thermus aquaticus, where, you know, it lived in a place where we didn't always think there was going to be life, right?
Yeah, I mean, that was really a surprise. So before that, microbiology thought that if you were going to live anywhere, maybe you would get up to maybe 120 degrees Fahrenheit or about that. But if you're going to do anything more than that, you had to be a spore-forming bacteria, which means that you could be boiled because you were as a resistant spore. And what Tom figured out was that there were all kinds of things living in essentially boiling water. I mean, water boils in Yellowstone at something like 92 centigrade, 95, somewhere on there. And so there were organisms living there. And it was hard to imagine that they were doing this. And not only that, but they were optimally adapted to whatever temperature you found them at. So if you move some of these bacteria cooler, where you think they'd do better, they don't. They insist on being at the temperature that they have become accustomed to over millennia.
As we heard from Joe Handelsman there, that unique bacteria paved the way for what we have now, this PCR method. Can you talk about how that flowed from the geyser to this bacteria to all these different ways that this technology gets used now?
Sure. You know, and I think it's fair to say that any medicine that has been in use in the last 30 years, maybe except for aspirin, ancestry diagnosis, the entire biotech industry, in fact, you know, owes its existence to this PCR and Thermus aquaticus. And how does that come about? It turns out that you can replicate DNA, and DNA is composed of two strands. That's your genetic material. And you can melt it. You can separate those two strands. But the way you do it is by taking the temperature way up. And it had been known in biology that there were these enzymes that were called DNA polymerases that if you supplied the raw materials and that enzyme, that they could make and duplicate and copy the DNA. But first you had to melt it. Well, the cell does this in very tricky ways, but chemically and physically you can do it just by taking the temperature up. So if you provide the right primers together with the raw materials and an enzyme, it will make two strands out of just one. Well, you got to let those come back together. Then you have to melt them again if you want to replicate that. Well, you can do that, but you need to add an enzyme. That same enzyme, that DNA polymerase. And that would require, every time you heat it up and cool them down, that would require adding more enzyme. Well, Kerry Mullis, in getting the Nobel Prize, figured out that, look, if I use Tom Brock's Thermus Aquaticus, I can use it at high temperatures. It doesn't care about boiling water. That's where it's the happiest. And so I'll take the polymerase from that organism and, in fact, use that to replicate DNA. And you can make millions and billions of copies of a specific piece of DNA by using the enzyme that came out of Thermus Aquaticus. And that was really revolutionary. That was in the late 80s, early 90s when that caught on.
We got an email from Kay in Waterford who says, Kay was a bacteriology major at UW-Madison in the mid-70s, taught by Dr. Brock, says he was far ahead of his time, passionate about the work. And Kay said on a trip to Yellowstone, they thought of Dr. Brock when they saw and smelled the thermal features there. Can you talk about the influence that he had, Hudson, on you and probably so many other students like Kay?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Tom was the godfather. He was the one that for me, exposed me, and I'm sure many other people, to the real principles of science and how to get science done and to have the enthusiasm for doing it. And, you know, I remember being in the lab sometime. You know, his office was actually built into the lab, but it was maybe, on a little platform, sort of sub-office, about 5 feet above the lab floor. And with Tom, being as tall as he is, he looked like Zeus coming down off Mount Olympus when he would walk into the lab. And he had this presence that would, you knew you had to produce at that point. You knew that you were going to get ready for presenting your data, and that he would be impressed if it was done well. He would say, well, yeah, I think you got a little farther to go. You need to work on that a little bit more. And so he set the standards high. He set the enthusiasm high, and he made sure that we were all going to match up to it. And I think without Tom and without his guidance and certainly without being able to publish a couple of articles with him, I would have never gotten into graduate school.
In our last few moments, can you, I guess, leave us with some inspiration from Thomas Brock for maybe the people out there, the younger people who might be the scientists of the future?
Yeah, it's important to do basic science. And that's what Thermus Aquaticus was about. Nobody cared, really, in the mid-60s about bacteria growing in hot springs. But there needs to be fundamental research done, because what that does is it creates the platform that you can't predict where it's going to go. And 25, 30 years after our discovery of Thermus Aquaticus, it made all the difference in the world and created industries and billions and billions and billions of dollars of enterprise, as well as saving millions and millions of lives.
Hudson, thank you so much for joining us.
Go for basic science.
Thank you so much for sharing these memories with us. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks.
That was Hudson Freeze, director of the Sanford Children's Health Research Center. He joined us for a look at the career of UW-Madison microbiologist Thomas Brock, who passed away last month. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the FDA is moving toward a ban on menthol cigarettes, saying they're a particular health risk for vulnerable people in the U.S. You can find out more and share your thoughts. You can use the pandemic to reinvent yourself as a person. Writer Olga Kazan is back with us to make the case that you could choose to be a different person as things open back up. and your job application to the future could include a resume, a cover letter, and proof of COVID vaccination. We'll find out how employers and employees are handling the COVID vaccine. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time. We haven't seen Western European countries invading each other for many years now, which is good news. And it looks like even when it does happen, it's only an accident and everybody takes things in stride. Belgium took over a small piece of France sometime over the last year or so, but nobody noticed right away. As reported by the BBC, it all started when a Belgian farmer with land near the border with France got annoyed with a rock in his field. So he moved it out of the way. But it wasn't a rock. It was a rock border. A local history fan noticed it on a hike in the woods and realized it was one of a series of stone markers that established the boundary between Belgium and France laid out in 1819, ratified in 1820. The farmer's unintentional invasion moved the border about 7.5 feet. Officials on both sides of the border say they believe they can resolve the incident peacefully. Belgian officials will ask the farmer to put the stone marker back into place. They can't sort it out, they'll have to reconvene the Franco-Belgian Border Commission, which hasn't met since the 1930s. Hey, does anybody in northern Wisconsin want to try this trick with the UP? It's border news you can use. This is Central Time.